Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys, and I want to thank you for taking the time out of your Saturday morning to listen. We have some special guests with us this morning. Ashley Michelle Pepon, is that how you pronounce it?
Yep, that's the French pronunciation.
Okay, and she is a survivor of acquaintance rape. She is also a co-moderator for After Silence, a message board dedicated to facilitating a healing environment for survivors of sexual violence. We also have Ed, how do you pronounce your last name, Ed?
Convoy.
And he is a therapist. He came to us through the Council for Relationships, which is a behavioral health provider here in the Pennsylvania area. And I believe our other guest, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Sylvia.
Yes.
Hi, Sylvia Coleman. Thank you for joining us this morning. She is an award-winning health journalist, and she also received a grant from the prestigious Leeway Foundation to create the Black Survivors, which is a national online support group and online resource center for Black sexual abuse survivors. I want to thank all three of you for coming on this morning to the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I just want to say that this is a very sensitive issue. We kind of take our time this morning just talking about things, and if people, you know, need time to just process what they're going to say, I completely understand. This issue affects children. We're also going to talk about adult sexual assault this morning. And if anybody out there thinks that, you know, this doesn't happen anymore, based on statistics, one in four girls are sexually abused before the age of 18. One in six boys are sexually abused before the age of 18. This is a very serious issue. Maybe we're hearing more about it now because of the mediums we have, the internet and cell phones and all kinds of stuff to make us more aware. Unfortunately, this happens a lot to people by someone they know, a family member or someone that they know that's close to them that is supposedly a friend. People who have been abused develop issues potentially as they get older, and it affects all their relationships, not just intimate relationships, but friendships as well. And then we talk about sexual assault. Women are afraid to walk down the street late at night because of this issue of possible potential rape, but sexual assault as adult also happens, unfortunately, by someone that can be close to you. It can be acquaintance rape in the case of Ashley Michelle. And it's like, where are you safe is the issue. You know, as a woman, where are you safe? But this also, again, I want to reiterate that it happens to men or young boys as well. And that's why I thought it was important to have this show today. I guess I want to start off with you, Sylvia. If you want to talk a little bit about your story and what made you apply for the Leeway Foundation grant.
Yes. The reason why I decided to apply for the Leeway Foundation grant is because I'm also a sexual abuse survivor. I'm actually an incest survivor, and my perpetrators were my brother and an older cousin at the age of 5 and also at the age of 14. And like so many sexual abuse survivors, I suppressed the memories for many years. And I didn't get help until my early to mid-20s. And through that process of actually going into therapy and support group and getting my life back, I decided that there needed to be other resources available to other sexual abuse survivors like myself. And what I found is, as an African-American woman, I was meeting other African-American sexual abuse survivors that were not getting help. And I said, something's wrong here. I need to find out why aren't they getting help and possibly establish a resource for them. And so I started volunteering my time to teach at the Temple University PASSEP program in Philadelphia, where I teach from victim to victor. It's a class for African-American sexual abuse survivors. So I was getting people here and there that was taking the class, but I said, there needs to be something else, something that people can use where they won't feel embarrassed, where they can remain anonymous. And so I applied for the Leeway Foundation grant and was accepted. And I used that grant to create blacksurvivors.org. And blacksurvivors.org is a national online support group for African-American sexual abuse survivors. And it's an online resources center because it has many different resources as it relates to sexual abuse in African-Americans. And this support group also allows for the people who participate to remain anonymous. So they can receive help. They don't have to worry about being found out. They don't have to worry about the shame that comes along with being a sexual abuse survivor for many survivors. And so that's why I started this particular resource, this online resource, to help other sexual abuse survivors that weren't reaching out and getting the help that they needed.
Do you feel that has helped you heal even further by working with other people and creating the website? Has it helped you further along in your healing process?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely had to reach a point, even before creating this resource, where I was comfortable enough and further along in my own recovery, where I felt comfortable sharing my story. But amazingly, I never thought I would take this path. But I enjoy it. I enjoy it immensely because every time I share my story, the shame lessens for me and my support system grows because I meet other sexual abuse survivors who share their stories. And I know that the work that I'm doing is important and the embarrassment and the shame is no longer there. And I've, in essence, taken back my power from my perpetrators. And that's essentially what many sexual abuse survivors are trying to do, regain some sense of normalcy and take back their power.
Ed, we have Ed Convoy here. He's a therapist, again, with the Council for Relationships. Maybe you can speak to the issue of why would someone do this to a child? Why would someone, especially someone that they know, a family member, in the case of Sylvia, she said incest, could you give us a little background? What is going through the perpetrator's mind to do something like this?
Well, it's difficult to overgeneralize. There's so many different types of perpetrators. If I could pick a typical scenario, it might be often perpetrator has also been a victim, if we use the males in this case, to himself, and that's one of the issues in treatment that we spend a lot of time with now, much more than we used to, in terms of working with young victims to make sure they don't become slightly older offenders. They're also, when we're dealing with pedophiles, they're a slightly different group of folks who very much they have a very, very immature sort of stilted development. Many times they will feel that they are actually peers with the child, even when they're a number of years older. So it's a very difficult generalization, and each one implies very different treatments.
It's different.
Yeah.
Now, what about in terms of, Sylvia also spoke about the issue of shame and embarrassment. Why does the victim feel so much shame when it was, you know, they it was done to them, like, you know, it was something wrong, like they had no control over it, especially in the sense of a child. They're you know, younger, physically usually less powerful. What is that your, is that a, something that happens a lot? And how can they, how can someone who's been through child sexual abuse, what is like one of the first steps they could do to help that, get rid of that shame and embarrassment?
Well, I was quite taken with what Sylvia was saying because I think she is modeling some incredibly important behavior for people who are want to move beyond just surviving, although surviving is an important issue. I think the issue of shame and also of an imbalance of power, very often children will take on an enormous amount of responsibility for adult behavior. it's often what kids will do. There's an assumption almost that I think there's that sense of might makes right kind of quality to this whole thing. And I think that even the shameful qualities of that also feed into that. So I think what Sylvia was saying is very important in terms of what's occurring. The other piece that's really, I think, crucial in this whole conversation is what Sylvia said about memory as well. Remember, most of these terribly abusive situations happen in secret and in private. It's not, and there's a way of holding that secret that becomes very, very damaging to the victim. And so this whole issue around that sense of what we call dissociation and that some people will think of as just forgetting, but it's much more than forgetting. So I think Sylvia was saying some very important things about how to bring this into the open, how to talk about it, and how to develop very crucial support networks that are beyond just the treatment phase, but also in areas like the program at Temple or other areas where people can really bring this out into the open. Very, very healthy thing that's occurring right now. It's a great trend.
Now, I also understand, unfortunately, children do report to their parents, to a relative, to a teacher, and people don't believe them, and they brush them aside. Why would an adult, when approached by a child, told that somebody's doing, like, I mean, my understanding is most children don't make this up. A lot of people think, oh, well, maybe the child made it up or something like that. Why would an adult, like, I have a daughter, and if she ever came to me and told me that someone did something to her, and I've had this conversation with her from when she was, you know, very young, when she would maybe she went to Girl Scout camp and things like that, you know, to explain to her what was, you know, the safe area, and if she felt uncomfortable, to come talk to me, and afterwards I would check with her. You know, I was like very paranoid, you know, that, you know, because I had this girl child. Why would someone not believe the child, Ed? What is that?
There's some cultural differences, but I think in general, some of it has to do with very often in certain family systems or in different groups that the identified perpetrator is often a very highly prized individual who has a significant amount of authority and influence in the family in many cases. That's one issue about it. The other part could be very complicated. In some cases, the mother who's being reported, who is getting the report, has also been a victim of abuse, and it could trigger lots of those same internal conversations that Sylvia was mentioning a little earlier. So again, that part is very complex. I think it's less and less so now. We've had a history in our country, I think, of discounting children in general, that they make flights of fantasy, and that they often, I think, in our culture over generations, it's been a sense of that children don't share sort of the adult real world kind of thing, and they can be very imaginative and things like that. That's diminishing rapidly now, especially in light of many of the sexual scandals in various organizations around the country. So I think that's slowly shifting. But again, in terms of family dynamics, it would be a very difficult to generalize. It depends on who it is and who's saying it. But very often, again, to reiterate what Sylvia said, very often that the reports come much later. That would be the most likely way that I would encounter that in treatment, is often that the presenting issue is not the abuse, but some other behavior that's disturbing or difficult or dysfunctional, and through the course of treatment, these other issues surface.
You know, a lot of people have been affected by this. On Sylvia, on your website, you have a list of different stars: Oprah Winfrey, Dorothy Dandridge, Iyanla Van Zandt, Jill Scott, Gary O'Union, Tyler Perry. So this doesn't just affect one type of person. I mean, it affects all people, colors. All over the world, children are affected by this issue. And Ed, you mentioned about the behavioral problems, that's maybe why somebody comes into you for the first case, but then you find out about the sexual abuse. And on the Darkness to Light website, it was talking about health and behavioral problems. Children who have been victims of sexual abuse are more likely to experience physical health problems, more symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, potential for drug and abuse, substance abuse issues, and also teen pregnancy and promiscuity issues that rise up. And I think, again, that's why I think it's so important that Sylvia and Ed, that you guys are working to help people. And it's just, it really makes me sad when I hear about, again, I have a daughter, when I hear something on the news or the radio about something happening to a child, I feel like a knife has been stabbed in my heart, because I know that child is powerless, you know, in a situation. I want to bring Ashley Michelle into the conversation. Ashley, good morning.
Good morning.
Ashley, again, is here. She came to me through the RAIN organization, and she is a survivor of acquaintance rape. Again, this brings up this issue that it's someone that you know. It's not this big, crazy, bad monster necessarily that, you know, is dark and ugly that's, you know, happening in the middle of a street. It's someone that she knew. Ashley, you want to talk to us a little bit about your story?
Sure, I can do that. And, you know, the most recent statistics that we go by from After Silence are actually RAIN statistics, but 73% of sexual assaults are perpetrated by a non-stranger, and of those, 38% of rapists are a friend or acquaintance, and that's where I fall into. And this was about 6 years ago when I was 18, and in many ways I was a typical victim, but I immediately wasn't your average survivor, because immediately after I was raped by someone that I didn't know very well, it was a social setting in that there were a lot of us over at this house, and I fell asleep on the couch. I didn't drink back then since I wasn't old enough. I'd never done drugs. At that point in time, I'd never even tried a cigarette, so I was very straight-laced. Good student, getting ready for my first semester at college, very close with my parents. My dad at the time was actually my best friend, and we were living together and having a wonderful time. And so in a lot of ways, even back then, I didn't have the concept of myself being your typical 18-year-old, not to mention the kind of person that would be primed to be a victim. And after it was over, it was a very weird situation. Like, he treated it like it was a date, even though I was there and I was crying and I was saying no and asking him to stop. A couple of different times I told him I wasn't sure, but I thought maybe I had a disease, which was patently not true. Just anything I could think of to try and get out of that situation. And it was very odd to me because I always had this concept of sexual violence involving knives or guns, and there wasn't anything like that. He never raised his voice to me. He never hit me. He never even used that much force to hold me down. The one thing he kept saying was that I wasn't acting like I didn't want it. And so immediately after I left, it was a very odd situation. I didn't know what had just happened, but I was pretty sure that I knew what I needed to do. And I went to the hospital right away and reported it. I had a rape kit done. And one of the things that really lingered on was I didn't want to report it because I wasn't sure that it was rape, but I was terrified, since he hadn't used a condom, of getting diseases or pregnancy, anything like that. I wasn't on the pill at the time. And so they told me I wouldn't be allowed to receive any prophylactics or services unless I agreed to report it. I've since found out that that's not true, but it's one of the ways that, you know, hospitals will try and take power away from survivors and coerce them into a corner of what to do. So I reluctantly agreed to press charges because I was that afraid of diseases and everything else, because I just didn't know. I was so naive that I really thought all of these horrible things could happen, because, as I said, he hadn't used protection. And the police came, and it was a brutal experience. I stayed in the hospital for 12 hours. They wouldn't give me clothes. They wouldn't do my rape kit. And ultimately, what ended up happening was, given the acquaintance situation, even though I hadn't been drinking, I hadn't been using drugs, and certainly that doesn't mean that if a victim does, she's to blame, but I had all of the right things going for me, and they still didn't believe me. And ultimately, what I had to agree to do was, I agreed not to press charges, and the police agreed not to file charges against me for filing a false police report. And I really thought that that's how it was handled. And I've since found out that it was pretty heinous. Our local RAIN chapter heard about what I went through because I had asked for a RAIN advocate. I'd asked to allow my friend to bring me some clothes. They kept saying no. And it was a really horrific experience. I do know that the police officers in my case were forced to undergo sensitivity training because of just the way that they handled it, including telling me I was doing it for attention. And it was really awful. And I spoke a lot about these experiences in a documentary filmed about 5 years ago called Swimming Upstream, which is about the secondary victimization we have in the status quo, courtesy of medical professionals and police officials and things along that nature. And unfortunately, what I found through my activism with the RAIN Speakers Bureau and After Silence is that I'm not rare. A lot of us have had that kind of horrifically awful secondary victimization. And the studies and the statistics prove that what often make sexual violence lingering and traumatic is how people react to it. If I had immediately had a lot of support, I think that it wouldn't have affected me so much in the long-term post-traumatic stress. I'm still in therapy, for example, and I feel that I've come a long way from where I was at 18, but, you know, that's 6 years of time in perspective. There was a long time there I was messed up, where I was getting into alcohol and doing things that I shouldn't have been doing because I didn't know how else to cope. It's one of the things that always stayed with me was that I wasn't believed and I wasn't validated. And there were some people that were there with me from the beginning, like my best friend, who I know is listening to this right now.
Ashley, Michelle, I just want to step in there for
sure.
A second. Thank you very much for sharing that. And I really appreciate, again, you taking the time to talk about your story. Ed, I just want to bring back to you, okay, we're talking now, we talked to Sylvia, and she was talking about the issue of incest, and she was abused as a child. Now we have Ashley and Michelle as an adult, and she was saying that there was no guns, there was no hype, there was no, you know, fanfare. So it was kind of very stealth, and maybe the person seemed calm even. I guess, is this, what's the difference between someone maybe abusing a child and someone abusing or attacking or taking, sexually assaulting an adult? Is there a difference? And what are the differences, do you think, Ed?
Oh, that's a difficult question. Let me think. Is there a difference? Well, there's a difference, obviously, in terms of with a child, there's no possibility for consent. In actually Michelle's situation, I think what she was speaking to, I think, is still a well-ingrained sense in our culture of sort of boys will be boys kind of thing. And I think that that's the piece that that I react strongly to when I'm in some, especially when I've been in some group settings with some men about that sense of, does no really mean no kind of conversation. And, in fact, no really does mean no. And the areas that these perpetrators will think of as gray areas, what the learning is, it's not gray.
Yeah.
So I think there are some distinctions, but I don't think they're that significant. It's also about control and about power, and about this sense of taking over someone else's will.
Yeah.
And that's the initial part. And then the re-victimization is so unnecessary, and it's so terrible to hear just like any trauma that Ash Michelle is talking about, any trauma, the immediate aftermath of the trauma is almost as significant as the trauma itself. If that can be handled in a sensitive way and really consciously with highly trained professionals who know what they're doing, the impact of the trauma is still going to be there. I don't want to minimize that, but the long-term effects can be dramatically different if the trauma itself and its aftermath is handled in a sensitive and competent way. Unfortunately, Ashley Michelle was speaking of probably one of the most incompetent ways that we hear about, and I hear about it a fair amount. So unfortunately,
yes.
I'm not surprised at what I've heard.
Well, I agree with you. I was reading an article here in the New York Times. It says the Pentagon toughens policy on sexual assault, and this was in 2005. It says acknowledging serious flaws in how it dealt with sexual assault within the military, the Pentagon announces steps on to prevent the crimes, investigate them more thoroughly when they occur, and treat victims with more consideration. So this is happening to civilians as well as within the military, and I just want to let the listeners know, who are, if you're on the phone and you're listening, you have a question, you can press the number 1. And also for the people in the chat room, you know, feel free to ask questions in the chat screen. I want to mention Sylvia's website. I put it in the chat screen. It's www.blacksurvivors.org. Sylvia, is there a phone number people can call if they want to reach out to you and be part of the online support group?
Well, it is primarily an online connection. They can reach me via email, and they can do that at info@blacksurvivors.org. That's the best way to reach me. And again, that's info@blacksurvivors.org.
Now, Sylvia, did you have help creating your website? Did you work with another survivor, or you reached out? How did you coordinate setting up your website and your resources and information that you have on there?
Well, I did a lot of research. A lot of the information came from the class that I already teach, the From Victim to Victor class. I already had a lot of resources and research that I had completed prior to doing the website, so a lot of information was transferable in compiling that information. And I did hire a web designer who helped to create the basic concepts and to organize and set up the actual website. And you'll see when you go on the site that the resources, the different resources that I use, are also noted in the footnotes, so you can see directly where a lot of the information came from.
Okay, we have a caller has a question. Hold on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, thank you for calling in. Did you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a survivor of domestic violence and rape, and really only after many, many, many years of therapy was able to relate it to some very early sexual abuse from the grandchild of my babysitter. But what I wanted to comment on is that although I had been in therapy for all of the secondary and tertiary problems, the kinds of behavioral patterns and family situations that were in my life, it was almost 30 years later before I actually went into therapy to deal with the issue of my own sexual violation and abuse. And I wanted to encourage people who are listening that although they may be fiddling around the edges of whatever it is that's going on in their lives, especially for us women, it's really hard to claim care for ourselves, but that is something that I've been able to do and benefit very much from doing that, specifically with an organization that specializes in working with abuse survivors.
Thank you so much for calling in and sharing that with us. Did you have any questions for our guests, or you just wanted to make a comment?
I wanted to ask them, when there is strong denial in the family, how do they work with adult survivors? Because people will point to or comment about certain patterns or conditions, but not necessarily to the underlying original incident or series of incidents. How do you get people to actually seek help for themselves?
Ed, do you want to answer that? Thank you very much, caller.
Well, that's a very tough question. In some cases, we can't. It depends on how much influence maybe various family members may have with the person. In my practice, I tend not to focus too much on whether the perpetrator admits to the acts or not. That can sometimes just become an impossible situation where then it creates, to me, needless tension in terms of focusing on the healing of the person who has been victimized. Where it's possible to create those situations where there can be a direct conversation, then we can work very hard to create the conditions for the victim to do that. But with great care that, again, we don't have a situation where he or she, mostly she in these cases, is re-victimized. So the denial is, especially after a significant amount of time, it can become a very difficult obstacle, but in many cases I work very hard for that not to happen. But it's a very difficult process.
Thank you, Ed. Ashley, I just want to mention that I connected with Ashley through the RAIN organization, and RAIN stands for Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, and their website is www.rainn.org. Again, www.rainn.org. And Ashley Michelle also works with After Silence, which is a message board. Ashley, you want to talk about, a little bit about After Silence and the resource that you have there?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. After Silence was actually started by two friends of mine, by the name of Vera and Lindy. They were each survivors who had their own separate websites set up, and they decided to come together and merge into this message board called After Silence. And I had been a member there for about 2 years or so when they were talking about promoting another moderator, and my boyfriend, Derek, was really supportive in pointing out how I'd gotten involved with speaking out, organizing Take Back the Night at my school, and at the time I was at school on a debate scholarship, so we knew I had a lot of talent with communication and speaking out, and he actually encouraged me to apply for the moderator position. And so I did, and Vera and Lindy brought me on board, and I got to see just how much they're really dedicated to helping survivors. And there's actually six of us moderators right now. In addition to Vera and Lindy, there's also Jesse, Nicole, and Kelly. And I've gotten to know these women, and all of us are survivors, although our stories are very different and we survive different things. Some of us are survivors of acquaintance rape like me. Others are survivors of childhood sexual assault. And what we try and do is facilitate a network of healing. We're not licensed therapists. Nobody who runs that message board is a social worker or a clinical psychology student, nothing like that. I mean, I'm a journalist and a full-time college student, but we're invested in trying to make the resources available to other survivors that weren't available to us when we were in our times of crisis.
Let's tell them the website address, Ashley Michelle. It's www.aftersilence.org, correct?
Uh-huh, yes.
Okay, again, www.aftersilence.org, and that's where you can go to touch base with Ashley Michelle and other moderators. I think it's important to create a community when people are going through such a traumatic issue, whether it's sexual assault or dealing with cancer or MS or anything, I think, traumatic. If you know that there are other people that are going through it, you feel a little better, you feel a little more at ease, and that you're not alone. I think that's an important issue. Sylvia, I wanted to talk to you about, what do you see for the future in your work dealing with child sexual abuse survivors? Are you going to continue teaching classes at Temple? Do you see yourself opening an institute? I mean, what's headed for the future for you?
Well, right now what I'm doing is I also wrote a book. It's called Creating a New Normal, Cleaning Up a Dysfunctional Life. And the book chronicles my recovery from sexual abuse. So right now, I am actively speaking and using that book as a tool in different workshops that I do, not only at Temple, but in the surrounding area and also abroad, to get the information out about awareness about sexual abuse and sexual assault. And I hope to continue to do that.
Can people buy your book online? Where can they purchase your book?
Yes, they can. Actually, they can purchase the book at www.writeprofessional.com, and that's W-R-I-T-E professional.com. And that is my journalism site. They can purchase the book directly from that link, and I will also be appearing at Borders Bookstore in Chestnut Hill on April 17th at 6:30 p.m., and that address is 8701 Germantown Avenue, and that's in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So at that location, I will have a book discussion and book signing where I will be talking extensively about this issue and the book. So my goal is to continue to definitely build up the support system online, to also bring the workshop to a broader audience so that other people are aware of what's going on in our communities. And as for whether or not I will formally launch an organization, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. Thank you. Ashley, Michelle, I also want to broach that question to you. What do you see for the future? Do you see yourself continuing working in this area of helping other women deal with sexual assault? Do you see yourself speaking more? Or is this just maybe till the end of the year or for the next couple of years? What do you see for the future in terms of your activism work?
I can't imagine my life without activism because everything that I am and have become is because I'm a survivor. I'll never know a life that could have been different because this is who I am. And I think activism will always be a part of that. And I consider myself very fortunate because my boyfriend is incredibly supportive. I'm actually getting ready to move from Kansas to California to be with him, and he's a personal injury attorney. And about 3 years ago, his bar organization helped increase the sunset provision on civil suits for rape victims, meaning that instead of dating the amount of time they have to sue their offender from when they were offended, it's when they start feeling the effects. So with recovered memories or delayed post-traumatic stress, things like that, it's from the date that that starts to affect them that they're able to seek a civil remedy through the status quo.
Is that only in your state, or is that nationwide, that law?
It's just in California. It's not
just
even
in California.
My state. It's just in California.
And say the name of that ruling again.
I'm sorry?
Say the name. What is the law called again, or what was the ruling that you just stated? Just say it again in case someone in their state wants to try to pursue getting the law changed.
Oh, it's called the Sunset Provision for Civil Remedy of Rape, I believe, something to that effect. I'm sure he's, like, rolling his eyes because I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Okay.
You know, and he's an activist, too. It's one of the things that attracted us together because we met at the National Debate Tournament, and we both just really have the passion that we feel we have an obligation to leave the world a better place. So even though my goal in life is to become a writer, I know I'll continue to speak. I'll continue to work with Rain and After Silence because I spent, you know, so many years of my life not telling anybody about this, and I will never be silent again. I feel like I just can't imagine even going back to that.
I want to give the National Sexual Assault Hotline. It's 1-800-656-HOPE, H-O-P-E. Again, the National Sexual Assault Hotline, 1-800-656-HOPE. And again, I just want to mention Sylvia Coleman's website, www.blacksurvivors.org. The RAINN website, www.rainn, that's two N's, .org. Also, Ed Convoy, you can touch base with Ed at Council for Relationships, which is, they have a website, www.councilforrelationships.org. And again, I just want to thank you all for coming on this morning. I want to talk about how, if a child is going through this, I mean, I'm sure there's no children at this time dealing with this, but you may know a child, maybe a child came to you, or maybe you as a teacher or someone in an administrative position notice something. How do you go about getting them help, Ed? What would be the best way? Would it be going to the police? Would it be going talking to the parents directly? How would someone go about it? If they have an inkling that maybe something's happening to a child, what would be the best steps they could take?
Well, depending on the situation, if they're in a school and they have guidance counselors or folks like that, or people in the administration that are skilled in this area. Nurses are quite good at this. Often it's for me, when I was a guidance counselor years ago, and things like this would come up, we would begin to focus on the behavior, perhaps bringing the parents in, even if we had an inkling about a possible abusive situation. We didn't necessarily start there because that can create lots of barriers to communication. We would start with looking at the behaviors, especially noticing significant changes in a behavior. Highly sexualized talk that would be inappropriate for that age. Some sort of acting out behavior. Often we would see something that was very different. Sudden delinquency or sometimes fairly outrageous behavior that we might have had that inkling, but we would begin to focus on that behavior and begin to move in that direction. If the child then spoke about that, then and the allegations are out there, then we would move very quickly to protect the child. We would bring in Child Protective Services here, DHS, Department of Health and Human Services in Philadelphia, whoever was the appropriate agency to make sure the child was safe. And then that creates a whole cascade of events.
Yes. Now, Ed, I also want to broach with you the issue that in terms of Ashley Michelle's situation as an adult, you know, acquaintance rape or sexual assault, what are some steps that women, or again, this happens to men. Men have been raped. Women have been abused as children. I don't want to just make it that only women. I think perhaps maybe when men, from my readings, and Ed, you can correct me if they're, you know, maybe they're young, teenage, or 12 years old, and it's a teacher. It could be a woman. We've seen in the news that there are many female teachers who are now having relationships with younger students. I'm not sure in terms of the clinical perspective, is that considered abuse? I mean, these people feel that it's okay, they're in love with these young students. How do you, Ed, could you speak to that issue of the what we've seen in the news with young female teachers having relationships with young teenage boys? That is considered abuse or no, or how do you label that?
There's no clinical difference. Again, there's some cultural differences where, you know, some people think of that as, oh, well, that's not harmful, that's whatever. But no, there's no clinical distinction about that. It's handled pretty much in the same way that we talked about before. I think we're learning an awful lot more about how to frame these conversations about the imbalance of power and the inappropriate use of influence and coercion and secrecy and the impact of that. And I think the corollary to that is what's happening in the community in terms of these kinds of organizations we've just been talking about with RAIN and After Silence and the Black Survivors organization, things like that. I hope none of my colleagues are listening, but I have to say that in my experience, some of the best therapy happens outside of the therapy offices. Some of the best therapeutic relationships are built by these support groups and these workshops and things that are happening. It's an entry point for many, many people, especially many women, who otherwise would feel powerless to do anything. And sometimes to step into a therapy office is much too big of a first step. So I encourage anyone who is in a situation to start where you are and to begin to find the resources that are available right in your community and not necessarily thinking you have to immediately start with therapy. That's certainly a wonderful, viable option, but it's often very daunting for people to start there, and it's not necessarily so. There's some great sort of therapeutic relationships that are built all the time in the community.
Thank you so much, everyone. We only have a couple minutes left, about 1 minute left. I want to thank Sylvia Coleman for coming on this morning. I want to thank Ashley Michelle for coming on. I want to thank you, Ed, for coming on. Again, people, if you're listening to the story, you have an inkling that maybe in your own personal life or in someone that you know is dealing with this issue of either child sexual abuse or a sexual assault. And so, as Ed said, there is necessarily no difference in terms of how it affects the victim. I would suggest that you reach out to the appropriate authorities or the family. And in terms of if you're a victim or a survivor, as we would like to say, then reach out to these organizations that are out there, blacksurvivors.org, rain.org, aftersilence.org, and again, Council for Relationships, which is in the Pennsylvania area, but anywhere in the country, RAIN or After Silence, many of these groups can help you. You could be in California or Atlanta or Florida or Colorado. They're there to help you and can provide resources to you. I want to let everyone know that next week we'll be not having a show. The next show will be April 18th, and we'll be dealing with women in prison issue. Why do women go to prison? What do they do when they're in there? How can they get out? When they get out, how can they find a job? How can they reconnect with their children? That's going to be on April 18th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. I want to thank, again, the callers and the listeners today. If you have a question for me, email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. Again, email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys. with joykeys@hotmail.com. And don't forget to mark Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you again, Sylvia. Thank you, Ashley Michelle. Thank you, Ed, for joining me. And I'll see you again on April 18th is the next show. We will not have a show next Saturday. Thank you very much, everyone.
You're welcome.
Welcome.